another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our ongoing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I took January off, got in a VW van with my wife and cruised down to Baja, California, and stayed pretty much offline the whole time, which was a remarkably delicious experience, especially at such a gruesome juncture in American history. And I felt there was a particular poetic quality in being in Mexico during that time. And it was interesting seeing how some of the characters there were already starting to get roiled up. One of the military checkpoints, the guys started asking us about Trump, and they were very gleeful with our intense dislike of the man and proclaimed him a racist. So things are, there's no way to escape it, but at least I had a brief respite before diving back in. Today, however, we're going to be moving in a different, somewhat different direction. In fact, a radically different direction, both more idealistic and more historical. So we'll put the Trumpocalypse on hold for an hour here. Over the last few years, there's been a really great deal of attention brought to the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, a fascinating conglomerate of hippies, idealists, acid mystics, dealers, smugglers, and surfers, who became one of the most significant drug distribution networks in the late 60s and 1970s, particularly regarding hashish and LSD. And their story was told in a book by Nicholas Hsu a number of years ago. And I'd known something about the Brotherhood, but that got me much more interested in their doings, as well as some of the major characters involved, including the sort of quote-unquote founder or one of the leading characters, certainly the most charismatic members of the Brotherhood, John Griggs, who remains a very fascinating character. But following Hsu's book, some of the leading lights of the Brotherhood that are still alive decided to make a documentary. And so the movie Orange Sunshine came out last year, William Kirkley's film, and it's a wonderful story of the more idealistic side of the Brotherhood, and you get an incredibly good slice of the kinds of mixtures of idealism and derring do that went into that aspect of the Brotherhood. But equally, and in some ways even more fascinating, is another documentary that has also just came out last year, but is now in theaters, select theaters across the country, and I think is available now for streaming online. And that is Cosmo Fielding Mellon's book, The Sunshine Makers. And this is a wonderful documentary that focuses on two chemists who were instrumental in making the Brotherhood of Eternal Love's most famous product, which were the LSD tabs known as Orange Sunshine. And these two chemists are Nick Sand and Tim Scully. And I'm very happy today that we'll be talking with Tim on the show. Just a little brief, hyper-compressed bio. Tim started in on the acid scene in the mid-1960s when he became the apprentice to the famous character Bear, or Owsley, as we kind of think about him. I always thought about him as Bear. The one time I got to meet him or sort of wave my hand at him, it was very clear that it was an appropriate name. And there's a new biography of Bear that just came out by Robert Greenfield, the guy who also did a bio on Timothy Leary. I haven't read that one yet. And from his encounter with Owsley, Tim went on to make LSD in the late 1960s in a number of labs before withdrawing from the activity in around 1970, which didn't keep him out of prison, although luckily he only had to do a few years at the end of the 1970s once he had already gone on to focus his incredible technical savvy on other topics, particularly biofeedback and computer programming, and ended up working for Autodesk for many, many years. A true psychedelic computer nerd, Bay Area born and bred. And so with no further ado, I want to welcome Tim Scully onto Expanding Mind. Hey, Tim, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. Hey, I'm kind of curious, you know, after so many years of, you know, doing your due, you've left all these crazy stories mostly behind you. I know you've been doing research on the history of LSD, but still living probably a fairly quiet life. And now there's, you know, a pretty good amount of attention that's been paid to the Brotherhood, to this new film by the Cosmo Fielding Mellon put together. What's it like to kind of, I don't know, come back into the discussion in a more visible way at this point?
Well, I have to admit that my natural inclination is to be a hermit, so it's a little uncomfortable, but it's fun too. So, a mixture of feelings.
That's good. One of the things that comes through the documentary and, you know, things that I've read is the tremendous idealism that motivated you and so many people and your colleagues in the 1960s. And, you know, sometimes it's hard from this distance for other people to quite understand that kind of idealism, maybe because the stories around psychedelics have changed so much. There's been so many shifts in the culture, and there's been so much demonization and of course, criminalization. Could you just talk a little bit about what that was like, how you sort of came into not only appreciating the power and interest of LSD, but really what fired your own idealism at the time and your beliefs that really by providing this material for more and more people, we could really actually change society in a major way?
Well, I was studying math and physics, and a friend of mine, Don Douglas, who went to kindergarten with me, was studying Oriental philosophy at the same time. And he started trying to do some intellectual cross-pollination. First, he turned me on to Tao Te Ching, and that I found that pretty interesting. And then he turned me on to Aldous Huxley's writing, and particularly Heaven and Hell, Doors of Perception, and Island. And those books got me very interested in psychedelics and in the mystical experiences that people could have from them. I should back up and tell you that my father was an Irish Catholic and my mother was an English Protestant, you know, in terms of their family backgrounds. And as a result, when they married, the religions sort of canceled each other out. So I was raised soaking up a deep skepticism of organized religion. And the idea of religious experiences that didn't have a church hierarchy between me and the experience was very exciting. So I set out and found some LSD, which Don and I took. And I knew that we might have a very frightening experience or we might have a wonderful mystical experience. And I wasn't disappointed. I had a mystical experience, a very intense feeling of oneness with everyone and everything in the universe. And my thought when I came down, which, and Don shared the same thought, we looked at each other and we thought that if we could share this experience with everyone, it might change the world drastically. And back in the 60s, in the mid-60s, the world was going to hell in a handbasket just as it is now, different immediate issues, but you know, we were at the peak of the Cold War, and we expected to be vaporized at any time, and environmental destruction was already something that we were keenly aware of. The Vietnam War was cranking up ever faster. Freedom rides were happening in the South, and we were more keenly aware of all kinds of social injustice. And we thought that if people had shared this same experience of oneness, of closeness with everyone and everything, that they'd be much less inclined to be so mean to each other and so destructive of the environment. And that was an idea that a lot of people who took LSD shared. It was a very common concept in 1965 and 6 and 7 that if everybody took LSD, that it might save the world. So it turns out to have been a very naive idea, but that's certainly where we started from.
Well, I'm curious to hear your reflections on the naivete about it. What prevents that from happening? Is it something because of the nature of human beings? Is it that the substance isn't quite as dependably mystical as it might have seemed at the time? What are the things now that when you reflect back, even though clearly there are very positive things and you still have very positive things to say about psychedelics to some degree, what are the things that you've come to recognize as being naive about that position?
Well, it's complicated. First of all, I had hoped that we could manage somehow to get financing so that we could give away a vast amount of LSD. Because my experience of buying it the first time was not a good experience. The guy I bought it from was a classic dealer who would have been just as happy to sell me amphetamines, cocaine, opiates, barbiturates, you name it. You know, I mean, all the drugs were on offer, and they were all equally illegal and demonized in short order. And I felt that if we had to sell LSD, that the chances are that people would start out the way I did with a bad experience just getting it. And they'd be exposed to a lot of other drugs to which they might, you know, be colorblind. And unfortunately, the government made every effort to make people colorblind. The propaganda against drugs carried a theme with it that all drugs are equally bad. And I think that was a really big strategic blunder on the part of the government, because all drugs aren't equally bad. Some are much worse than others, and more immediately physically dangerous or psychologically dangerous. And convincing people that they're all equally bad basically convinced most of my contemporaries that the government lied, and that tempted a lot of people to fall into the fallacy of believing that if all drugs weren't equally bad, maybe they were all equally good. And that led a really depressing number of people to take bad drugs, speed, cocaine, opiates. I mean, even very intelligent people like Jerry Garcia, who should have known better. So that was one problem. Another problem was that, another problem was that a lot of people perceived LSD as a party drug. They came to perceive it that way. And that was at least partly because Bear fell in love with the Grateful Dead and the acid test, and his LSD became inextricably intertwined with the San Francisco and worldwide acid rock scene. And he gave away lots and lots of acid at musical events. And over the years, LSD distribution was very common at Grateful Dead gigs. So that meant that a lot of people were coming into the LSD experience in a partying frame of mind instead of in a spiritual frame of mind. They were doing it in a Dionysian setting, not in an Apollonian setting. They weren't going to a quiet place in the woods or sitting quietly in front of a fireplace. You know, they were in a wild party. And that, I don't think that that's an ideal setting for having a spiritual experience. Certainly some people did, and I don't have anything against parties, but I wouldn't have chosen to go to prison for a long time so more people could have parties. I was really hoping that people would have a more spiritual peak experience.
That was something you came in with. Like, you came in, you had already been reading, you had already, you know, you discovered Taoism. So for you, it's a fascinating paradox to me that it's clear that like other psychedelics, LSD can occasion profound, life-changing, mystical experiences. Whatever we exactly mean by mystical experiences, It's you know, everything but the kitchen sink is in there. But at the same time, this whole thing about set and setting is really no joke. That intentionality, the environment, your expectations, your preparation, all of these things play an enormously powerful role in sort of setting up these experiences. So it's a funny, you know, in a way, because in a way, mystical experience is so much larger than you are, your personality, your individual desires, even your desires for mystical experience. It's so much larger than that. And yet, in some ways, you have to kind of, or maybe, I'm not sure, do you have to kind of intend to have that kind of experience? Otherwise, it just becomes a party drug, or it becomes, you know, just a weird, you know, experience of lights and like special effects or something. It can be profane too. So what is that secret? What is that possibility? Is it something inherently challenging about the compound? Is it an attitude that people have to have? What can make that a spiritual experience?
Well, I'm not sure I have all the answers. In fact, I'm pretty sure I don't. But I think that taking it in nature in a quiet setting with the intention, you know, with some preparation and treating it, not doing it frivolously, certainly helps. I think the more frivolously you approach it, the more likely you are to have a frivolous experience. You sort of get out of it some of what you put into it. I mean, I see psychedelic drugs as being more amplifiers than I did back when I first took them. When I first took LSD, I really thought that LSD carried a message with it that everybody would get, or most people would get, just by taking it. If I scattered it to the four winds, I thought most people would get it. But that turned out not to be necessarily true. And as you know, it tended to amplify to a great extent whatever your intentions were in the beginning. So people like Charlie Manson could turn on a bunch of people and go out and murder. The CIA could try to find a better interrogation tool. You know, the army could try to find a better weapon. The blind man and the elephant, this is a big elephant, and there are a lot of blind men grabbing different parts of it and seeing really different beasts.
Yeah, I like that. What, in terms of these different blind men, what was Bear's approach? I mean, how much did your sense of acid's possibility mesh with his, or how did your experience of meeting him, and I'd love to hear, if you've read the new biography, what you think about it, but such an interesting character. What was your experience of him, and how did that shape your own hopes for LSD in the 60s?
Well, when I first took LSD back in early 65, April 65, I immediately wanted to make a lot and give it away. And I set out to try to find the raw materials and the know-how. And I found out it was really hard to get. The raw materials were hard to get. The know-how was available in the library, superficially at least. But by the end of 1965, I was still trying to hook up with a source of raw material when I met Bear. I met him because I'd been doing electronics consulting work to make a living while I was going to college, and I had been able to earn enough money to put a down payment on a house, and I was renting rooms out to fellow students to make the mortgage payments. One of those students went to a party at Ken Kesey's house and met Bear. She got to know him in a closet, because that was the only place where they could be private. And then she told him, among other things, that her landlord was an electronics guy who wanted to make acid. And he showed up knocking on my door a few weeks later, I think because he wanted to chat her up more than he wanted to see me. But we ended up talking. He had zero interest in an apprentice in making acid, which is what I wanted. I wanted to become his apprentice. But we talked about electronics. And a few weeks later, the Muir Beach acid test happened, and Bear had an epiphany that he believed that the Grateful Dead were going to play a key role in turning on the American culture. So he started getting involved with them, and that led to eventually Phil Lesh inviting him to be their sound man. And when that happened, he turned to me and said, well, would you like to come and do electronics work with me for the Grateful Dead? So my friend Don and I ended up traveling with the Acid Test and the Grateful Dead for a few months. And I saw that as an extended job interview for the job I really wanted, which was his apprentice in the lab, but he had to grow to trust me. So traveling with the Grateful Dead was like running away and joining a circus, totally outside my comfort zone, but very interesting and exciting.
How did you fare? You know, just watching, you know, I know a little bit about you. I've seen you, I've read interviews with you. I've seen you in the film. We have some mutual friends. And sometimes I try to imagine you in these environments that are totally wild, you know, like being on the road with the Grateful Dead in the 1966 or at the Acid Test or whatever. And you talk a little bit about outside your comfort zone, or that you're a little bit more, you're more of a natural hermit. That you're more introspective and probably you like controlled environments. What was it like for you? Like, did you rise to the challenge? Did you find your ways to kind of keep a little island of sanity in these scenes? How did you learn to embrace these experiences?
Well, the good news is that the Grateful Dead and the folks who hung out with them were nice people, and so living with them was nice from that point of view, and that they weren't bad people to live with. But I mostly, I do have a touch of Asperger's, I think, and I really am most comfortable dealing with people one or two at a time. So I would, you know, sort of build a little technical bubble up for myself and work on the jobs that I had, solving the technical problems that helped the band do what they were doing and furthered the project that Bear was trying to move along. And at the acid tests, you know, we all took acid together at least once a week and got very loaded. And I guess part of the idea from Bear's side was he wanted to find out how I behaved in that circumstance and could I do technical work while I was loaded. And I found that I could. And so I was able to satisfy him. But I generally tended to focus on what I was doing, operating equipment and wiring up the instruments and so on, more than I've never been particularly into dancing. I grew to like the music the band played, but, you know, I did lose my virginity pretty quickly, but that was fun. But I did mostly keep more to myself than the rest of the gang.
One of the wonderful things about your story, and it's true for Bear as well, is, you know, not so much the intertwining of the Grateful Dead and psychedelics in American culture, which is a well-known story, and enough said about that. It's actually more the intertwining of psychedelics and electronics and a sort of technical creativity that both you and Bear had it in different ways. And of course you went on later in your life to work with biofeedback, and you built a computer, an early computer in the late 50s as a high school guy. I mean, this connection in your life and others between technical problems, challenges, technical creativity, electronics and psychedelics, to me seems significant in a way that maybe other people don't draw as much. It's been a longstanding interest of mine. I'm always interested when I meet technical people who are interested in psychedelics. They have often have a somewhat different take on it. And I'm curious for you at that time or over your life, you know, it doesn't really matter when, but when you think about it, how are those things sort of related for you? Is there a relation? Is there something about the worldview you develop if you're working intimately with electronics that gives you a different kind of sense of what's happening, perhaps with psychedelics or with the manufacturer of psychedelics?
Well, when I was an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, the only time I got a good grade on an English paper was when I wrote an essay about a speculation that came to me when I was exposed to quantum mechanics about the Schrodinger wave equation. And one way of solving the Schrodinger wave equation is by summing waves that pervade throughout space and time, which cancel out, destructively interfere in most places, but constructively interfere in the region where you think the particle is, to show a probability curve for the location of the particle. And the conjecture that caught my fancy at that time was that perhaps those notional waves pervading throughout space and time associated with every particle have on some level a real existence, and that we are all intimately connected with everything else in the universe on that level. And that was before I took LSD, but that notion has always stuck in my mind and became a mental model for me of the sense of oneness that happens with ego loss. And, you know, there are a lot of ideas in quantum mechanics and modern physics that seem kind of mystical. So they're blurrings of the boundaries between mystical experiences from psychedelics and mystical experiences from advanced physics and math. And then, of course, there's the question of the notion of computers as mind amplifiers. I mean, the World Wide Web and computers make it possible for you to have access to almost any information in human knowledge very quickly. And that was an idea that was just a glimmer in our eyes back in the 60s and 70s, but it was already an idea that technology people were beginning to think of, that perhaps through the use of computers there'd be a way of digitizing all the world's data knowledge and making it widely available. We didn't imagine all the trivial uses it would be put to, but...
Well, I was just going to ask you that. I mean, that's... Again, one of the interesting things I think that's happened over the last 5 to 10 years is that people have become more and more aware of the way in which the major computer corporations, Apple, Google, et cetera, have, you know, they owe some of their DNA to this strange mixture of psychedelic underground culture and technical culture, particularly in the Bay Area, though not exclusively. And you can trace these links. These links are real, that there's a real relationship between the counterculture and cyberculture, to quote one of the histories of this connection. And so at the same time, then you can look at like contemporary computer culture, what the corporations have done with this, where we are with Google, with corporate surveillance. I mean, there's a lot of things we could talk about. But I'm curious from your perspective, since you saw the glimmer way back, and have been kind of working on in this way on some of the positive uses of technology. We've already mentioned biofeedback, and you've also done a lot of technical work on using computers to aid people with handicaps, people who can't communicate, building computer interfaces. You did that in the late 1970s. Amazing foreshadow of the kinds of things people are doing now to use technology to help people who are otherwise impaired. At the same time, it's not exactly utopia. So I would be curious how you see things now in terms of that potential, that mind expanding positive potential of computers and where we are now.
Well, I have to admit I've got some mixed feelings. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that there's a wave of automation that's going to be breaking over our culture in the next few years, and that even though Mr. Trump seems to think that xenophobia is the answer to people losing their jobs, I think a lot more people are going to lose their jobs to automation than they will to immigrants in the next generation. We're going to go through some really major cultural revolutions as it becomes less and less necessary for people to work due to advances in technology. And the question is whether there's any way for society to evolve to make that a positive transition. At the same time, we're going to be confronting all the results of climate change, and it doesn't seem as though we're making much of an effort to prepare for that in this country anymore. So it's hard to be optimistic at the moment, but it's certainly true. I still believe that there can be technological solutions to major human problems, but unfortunately, we've got to make good decisions as to how to use the technology, and so far we don't seem to have a really great track record. I was hoping that psychedelics would help with that, but one of the things that discouraged me in the aftermath of scattering LSD to the four winds was the fact that a depressing number of people who took acid ended up being victims of magical thinking. So that you see a lot of people who are ex-hippies who think that vaccination is an evil thing, that fluoridation is evil, that science is a bad thing, and basically rejecting the notion of the scientific method. That's really unfortunate, in my opinion.
Yeah, we're at such a funny point that way with psychedelics now, because on the one hand, we've had the psychedelic, we're in the midst of this renaissance, if you want to call it that, where there's a much more attention paid to psychedelics within university settings, psychology labs, neuroscience. It's become clear that there's a way to approach these things somewhat scientifically. And so there's sort of a new sense of psychedelics as being things that are not hostile necessarily to science. And at the same time, probably the most vibrant aspect of contemporary psychedelic culture, the people who are devoting themselves seriously to exploring with these compounds, a lot of probably the most kind of culturally influential aspect here is the extraordinary rise in people interested in ayahuasca and taking ayahuasca. And a lot of the people who are doing that have very religious ideas about what this is about. And some of there's a lot of magical thinking going on out there. And so it's a very strange paradox that the contemporary psychedelics in our contemporary world are simultaneously objects of science, even more so than they ever were. And at the same time, they are fuels in good and in negative ways for a kind of religious worldview or a kind of spiritual worldview that can very easily tend towards magical thinking, towards a rejection of rationality or a scientific method as being all part of the problem, and we need to change our minds entirely. It's a very strange paradox. Do you have any sense for yourself about how to square the need for scientific method to remain conversant and aware of scientific truths of mathematics, et cetera, and at the same time to give space for the possibility of genuine spiritual experience and the kind of moral and spiritual change in one's worldview? How do you do those two things at the same time?
Well, I think that it's not an either-or thing. It needs to be both and. The secret to life, in my opinion, is learning to be flexible and learning how to shift gears. So you need to be able to think inside the box, and you need to be able to think outside the box. And you just pick the appropriate mode of consciousness for the situation at hand. That's one of the things that biofeedback training, that's one of the best ways of using biofeedback training, for example, is to learn how to recognize different states that your body can be in and how to shift among them. But that doesn't necessarily, learning those skills has to be supplemented by having some good judgment in terms of how to apply them, just as with psychedelic drugs and with science and of all the rest. And I haven't found any magic solution for teaching people good judgment.
That's the one of the pull quotes from this interview. I love it. But since you mentioned biofeedback, I'd like to ask a little bit about that. You published a number of articles in the late 70s after working with it throughout the decade and coming up with new protocols and seeing different ways that it could be applied. Well, that was a long time ago. And, biofeedback clearly works to some degree, and yet it didn't really penetrate the culture so much of the next or the following decades. And now it seems to be making a bit of a resurgence because there's more and more inexpensive brain sensing devices. There's a kind of new consciousness hacking movement of people who are interested in exploring states of consciousness more from a kind of technical, machine supported way rather than a mystical or Buddhistic way. So it sort of seems like the time is right for maybe another take on biofeedback. So I'd love to hear your sense of it after working with it for so long. What are its strengths? What are the weaknesses or the restrictions? How are things change? How do you see things changing today?
Well, briefly summarizing a little bit of the past, I got into biofeedback immediately after dropping out of making LSD, and I got into it because I was fascinated with research that people like Joe Kamiya had done with voluntary control of alpha brainwaves and the relationships that had been noticed by various researchers between alpha brainwave production and various meditators, Zen monks, yoga masters, and so on, often produce lots of high amplitude, high quality alpha waves when they're practicing their disciplines. So I started making simple little single channel alpha brainwave trainers and making those widely available, and fairly rapidly learned that, unfortunately, it's not quite that simple. Just learning to produce alpha brainwaves doesn't necessarily mean you're going to learn how to meditate, because we were only looking at one scalp location, just one channel of EEG. Modern gadgets can look at 8 or 16 channels, which is much better. It wasn't until I started making at least two-channel EEG instruments where you could do interhemispheric phase synchronization training that we could start getting relatively reliable correlations between a brainwave pattern and a state of mind that was calm, centered, and meditative. And then as I eventually got into doing more sophisticated research with physiological patterns and states of consciousness, I got it that the more various physiological measures you can look at, either more channels of EEG, or also look at things like a couple channels of EMG, maybe peripheral skin temperature, skin conductivity or resistance, the more parameters you can look at once, the better quality correlations you can find between physiological patterns and states of consciousness. And any physiological pattern that you can measure, you can build a biofeedback machine to train for. Unfortunately, in the early years, the Biofeedback Research Society was wide open, and research in doing biofeedback for states of consciousness or for high learning states and education were equally interesting to the society as people who were doing early medical research. But by the time I got out of prison and started up a company making biofeedback instruments again, the biofeedback community had pivoted pretty strongly toward medicine and fee-for-service biofeedback and insurance reimbursements. And the Biofeedback Society reorganized itself to become a group lobbying for all of those things, to lobby for legal recognition of what they were doing, for insurance company recognition, and for people to be able to make their livelihood doing medical biofeedback. And that's been very successful, but it wasn't very interesting to me. I've always been much more interested in what healthy people could do for self-improvement than I have in working with people who had medical issues. So I'm very happy to see things like the brain-computer interface group that's making inexpensive multi-channel EEG systems and open source software so that people can tinker with this now. And I'm hoping that people will get more interested in some of the self-improvement applications and start working with pattern biofeedback for various states of consciousness.
Yeah, it still seems like the message hasn't quite gotten out yet. Just the sort of basic marvel of biofeedback, in the sense that you really can train yourself to quote unquote control, or, you know, call into force states of mind, experiences, states of the body that you're barely most of the time not even aware of. You know, that there is this strange kind of control that is available that opens up once you have some kind of way of modeling the state that you're aiming for. Does it seem like there's still more there to learn about how we can control? Isn't really the right word, but how to open up into these desirable states using these kinds of technologies?
I'm sure there's a lot more that can be done. I got sort of sidetracked from working on that into other areas, so I haven't followed up as much as I would have liked to. I doubt that I'm going to have the time now to get back to that before I run out of warranty. But I think that there is a lot that can be done. And you're right in saying it's not exactly control. What it is learning how to be aware of these various states and how to notice what things you can do that either encourage them or discourage them. And by doing biofeedback training, you can learn those skills so that you no longer need to have the biofeedback instrument. You still have the skill that you learned using it. And hopefully you can learn how a portfolio of different states that may be appropriate for different situations, and hopefully you can learn how to observe in your own life which states are more successful for you in a given situation, so you can choose to encourage the ones that work for you and encourage and discourage the states that don't work well for you. So, and that's rapidly converging with many kinds of meditation, where what you're doing is observing what you're doing, noticing, you know, what the kind of stories that you're telling yourself, the ways in which you're interacting with the world. And the more that you're conscious of what you do, the more that you, the observer, can see what your different personalities are doing out there in the world, the more able you'll be to make appropriate choices.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I really admire about you and your work and the way in which you are, you know, you've represented yourself in this documentary and then in other things that have told your story, is the way that you have your idealism didn't go away. You didn't become cynical. You didn't sell out. You just shifted the domains where you were working through these different kinds of zones. And there's always this sense of a kind of ethical drive in your work, even if you're, you know, hanging out with the Grateful Dead, or, you know, you're in prison, you know, when you could just have, you know, been unhappy. Instead, you did a lot of good work there, helping people and such. And for me, one of my favorite moments in the Sunshine Makers in the documentary is when you talk about the period just when the government had, you know, finally caught up with you and Nick, and, you know, your mutual acquaintance Billy Hitchcock spilled the beans, and so they had all this data they wanted, and you had an opportunity to turn on your friend and maybe avoid prison. And prison's scary, and you obviously have good things to do, you know, a lot of stuff to do in your life. And you talked about the kind of ethical, that moment, and just how you kind of dealt with that temptation, which is always a part of these stories. It's always a part of the, you know, the noble outsiders or outlaws who, when the law finally gets them, you know, turn against each other in order to save their own skins. And in a way, it's another kind of very ethical act to not do that. And I would just love to hear a little bit about that period in your life when you sort of saw something about what it meant to be a good person or to, you know, stand up for your ideals in the face of very scary possibilities.
Well, I don't know what I would have done if the government had said to me, just testify against your friends and you'll walk free. At the last moment after Billy had already put me firmly in the government's sights. Both Billy and I made every effort to avoid getting put in that situation. He actually dodged grand jury subpoenas along with me for a number of months to try to avoid being forcibly immunized and forced to testify against Nick and other people. It wasn't until they finally closed in on him and had his bank records so they could indict him for tax evasion and Regulation T violations that he finally gave up and decided to testify. By the time he'd done that, I don't think the government would have been prepared to let me walk away. They would have given me a light sentence. When I thought about it, I thought that there's no way that I could feel good about doing it. And in any case, there was also no way I was going to avoid being in prison. And I didn't see any point to it. It seemed much better to me to take my medicine and see what happened.
Well, I'm glad that
I don't claim to be here.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I don't claim to be a saint or anything. You know, I'm not mad at Billy for what he did. I understand the situation he was in. And he did his best to try to minimize the damage he did. During the trial, I was in communication with him. He knew that I was going to claim that we were making something that wasn't illegal. And he tried to support that claim in his testimony until finally the government took him in a back room and put his feet to the fire and said, if you don't say LSD instead of acid, you're going to go to prison.
Yeah, it's impossible to know how one would react in those kinds of situations. There's another character from that period that I want to ask you about at the end. I know it's a long story, but one of the more interesting things that's happened in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, again, around discourse around psychedelics and the underground is a growing kind of a conspiracy theory model where LSD is seen as has always been part of a kind of CIA plot, and that, you know, the major pop stars and manufacturers behind them all is some kind of conspiracy by the CIA or other actors to introduce LSD into the counterculture to blunt its political revolutionary potential. And some of these ideas have some merit, and some of them are very, very wild and kind of silly. But one character that plays an interesting role in all this is of course Ronald Stark, who kind of shows up in the 1970s, steps into the vacuum left by you know, earlier characters leaving the kind of Brotherhood network, and a very mysterious character who was identified in a legal proceeding in Italy later on as being a CIA, working for the CIA. And I read online in some interview that you have your doubts about this, and I know that you've been devoting a lot of your more recent years to researching and compiling information about underground LSD production and the whole crazy story, one of the great stories of the 20th century as far as I'm concerned. But I have to say, I'm very curious of what your take on Ron Stark is, and then this larger question about the role that the CIA or other intelligence agencies had in actually fomenting the psychedelic scene for their own purposes.
Well, you have to color me deeply skeptical about the CIA deliberately creating a psychedelic scene. I think that that idea is suitable for fertilizing gardens. And I think it's interesting. In a lot of cases, some of the same people who believe in conspiracy theories are the same people who have suffered from other kinds of magical thinking. Anyway, Ron Stark is certainly was an interesting character. I did know him. He did con me successfully for a number of years. He's one of the reasons I got interested in researching the history of underground LSD manufacturing. I wanted to try to understand his story. And I've spent quite a few years digging up records, interviewing people who knew him, getting the court records of most of his various court cases around the world. The Italian thing, by the way, just to take one example, Ron was busted in Italy with a number of drugs and with smuggled cars and false identities. And he got sentenced to 14 or 15 years in Italian prison, and then spent a number of years trying to wiggle his way out of prison. At the same time, he was keenly aware that there was an indictment waiting for him in San Francisco, in our case, with Nick and me and Mike Randall. He was indicted in that same case, and he was trying to figure out a way to get out of Italian prison and avoid being immediately extradited back to the United States. And he tried various schemes while he was in prison. One of them was that he tried to convince the Italian authorities that he had an inside track to what some of the Italian radical groups were doing, like the Red Brigades. And he pretended to snitch them off by giving interviews in which he told pretty fanciful stories, which were a mixture of science fiction and stuff that had already been published about them, to various counterintelligence people in the Italian government. While he was in prison, there was a fellow named Aldo Moro, who was a former prime minister of the Italian government, who was assassinated. And the Moro assassination is a little bit analogous to the Kennedy assassination in that there are endless conspiracy theories that have swirled around the Moro assassination. And there was a Moro commission that met for years that produced a report that's more than 100 volumes long, that investigated many, many different theories for how the Moro assassination came about. And Ron managed to get tangled up in that investigation, which is how I was able to get a lot of his court records from Italy, because a lot of them were published in the Moro Commission report. Anyway, it's a long, long story, and we've only got a few minutes.
Briefly, I was just about to lean in on that one. You know, maybe the thing that I want to ask about is just that gives me just a taste of the kind of research you've been working on. Where are you with this project? I mean, I can only imagine you have an enormous amount of material. Is it going to see the light of day? How are you deciding how to work with this huge archive?
Well, first of all, I'm trying to make arrangements so that if I drop dead, that a university will take it over so it doesn't get lost. I've temporarily put the larger history project on a back burner, or on a large number of back burners, because there's a lot of different pots that I'm stirring there, lots of different cases I'm working on, while I work on a memoir, because I want to do is fill in the missing parts of the story of the Sunshine Makers. So the first book that I hope to publish will be a memoir, sort of a memoir plus. You know, it basically covers the same territory that the Sunshine Makers did, but in a lot more detail. And the second book that I intend to publish, if assuming that I have time to manage to get that far, is a biography of Ron Starr.
That's one. That would be wonderful.
So that's sort of my, you know, and then I'd like to go back to the broader history project, because there are lots and lots of other labs and other people that are also very, very interesting, and a lot of interesting connections between them. But the history project at this point consists of many thousands of PDF files that are massively hyperlinked, that are chronologies per person, per lab, per place, and so on, for making sense out of a very large amount of information that I've gathered so far. And that's a useful source of information for me in terms of writing books that are more linear narratives, like a memoir or a biography of Ron Starr.
Well, I'm really glad you're working on that material, and that there'll be more light cast on this fascinating story. One just final little question. Did you read the new biography of Bear from Robert Greenfield?
I did, and some of the information about Bear's early years was new to me and very interesting. I was kind of disappointed in the coverage that he gave to the acid years, and you know, I felt like he sort of ran out of gas. He certainly didn't bother to talk to any of the people I know who knew Bear during those years, so there's a lot more of Bear's story that has yet to be told. Greenfield's book is certainly worth reading. I mean, likewise, I thought that his book about Tim Leary was well worth reading, but it's not the whole story. There's more to be told, and you know, I suppose and maybe if I were to do a third book, it might be a book about Bear. I don't know, but there's a lot more to tell about him.
Great. Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, Tim. I'm really glad to hear that you're working on a memoir. Hope to see that before for too long, and really appreciate you coming on Expanding Mind and talking with us today.
Okay, well, it's been fun talking with you.
Great. Folks, that was Tim Scully, one of the acid chemists featured in the new film Sunshine Makers.